Hello, and thank you for downloading this Conversations podcast. If you don't already subscribe, you can do it completely free of charge. It's easy. Details are on our website, abc.net.au/conversations, or just look for Conversations with Richard Feidler through iTunes.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. Andrew Robb is a senior Liberal Party frontbencher. Before he was in Parliament, he'd been head of the National Farmers Federation. He'd also been the Liberal Party's campaign director in the 1993 election, which they lost, and the 1996 campaign, which brought John Howard to power. Andrew Robb, well, it's fair to say he's never been seen as a wildly gregarious person, but he's always been regarded as serious, interested in the nuts and bolts of policy, and alive to the dynamics of political campaigning. At the end of Malcolm Turnbull's tenure as Liberal leader, Andrew Robb was privately being urged by his colleagues to take the leadership from him. And if you caught Andrew Robb at the right time of day, he'd think, well, why not? But in a bad moment, he'd worry how he'd manage. In 2009, Andrew Robb surprised everyone when he quietly made it known that he was dealing with depression, that he'd be stepping down from the front bench to get it treated properly. He's back on the front bench now, and his new book is called Black Dog Days, Public Life, Private Demons. Andrew Robb, welcome to Conversations.
Great to be with you, Richard.
Let's begin by saying you were never a morning's person, Andrew.
Well, that's very true. That's not true, actually, because I'm one of nine children, and my mother said in those early years I was the happiest of the nine. It was when I was about 12 or 13 that I first realised I was becoming not a morning person, and it's persisted ever since.
What was the feeling you had as soon as you woke up in those days?
Well, I go to sleep taking on the world, and even as a 12-year-old, I was in a diocesan class, a school class. Back in those days, there was a big attempt to get a government scholarship in year eight, and there was a special school in Melbourne that the Catholic Church organised, and they would take students from around the suburbs to try and ensure that they maximised the number of scholarships, because many of the families couldn't afford to send their kids to school without a scholarship. So I was in this class. They worked us very hard, and I'd still be often at 11:30 at night doing homework, and I'd often feel very pleased with myself going to bed as a 12-year-old, having done this work and thought I'd done it quite well. As soon as I woke up, I'd have this great doubt about the work I'd done the night before. And
was it a sinking feeling?
Very sinking feeling. In fact, it's later in life it got to the point, often when I woke up, the instant I woke up, I'd feel like I did the night before. In other words, it was sort of a half a second or a mini second of confidence, and then I felt I was going through an elevator and down the floors, and then I'd hit the basement and I'd go, oh, and I'd be in this funk.
God, that's cruel, isn't it? I mean, it's one thing to start at the bottom, yes, but then to start at the top and have the plummet and then try and work your way up.
It was extraordinary phenomena, really, but I just thought that's what not being a morning person must be like. Put it down to that for a long time, because I didn't want to admit to anything else, really.
Did you have workarounds? You know, knowing that you were feeling that way in the morning, avoiding making important decisions, for example, or sequestering yourself away from people to get around that feeling?
Yes. In the end, I had all sorts of strategies and some were, you know, quite sad when you think about it. But, I mean, initially I was just quiet, so I wasn't so grumpy. I probably was later in life in the mornings, but I just didn't want to talk to anybody. I felt no confidence. I'd just go about doing what I had to do, and I had routines with long hot showers seemed to help me to some extent, but I had a really fairly solid routine. I could read papers, but I didn't want to listen to radio. I've never listened to or watched morning television until the last 18 months. I'd listen to radio because a lot of the jobs I had, but I'd listen to the news and turn it off. Listen to AM, turn it off.
Sometimes the news ain't great, is it?
Well, I'd have to see whether there's something I had to know about and act on. Right? But
did your family know better than to poke the bear with a stick in the morning?
I think they got, I suppose, conditioned, especially with my kids and my wife, that I didn't engage much in the morning. I wouldn't, if the kids asked me questions, I'd answer them, and I'd really work hard at saying good morning, everybody. You know, even those sorts of things, I'd have to work hard at, and just the normal social interaction. But then about 8:30 in those early decades, I'd pop out of it.
You'd come good.
I'd come good. I'd be a different person. I'd all of a sudden be passionate about things and a decision maker, and I've run organisations for 30 years, so I get things done. I like challenges. I like responsibility. But for those first 3 or 4 hours, it wasn't the case. The opposite.
I think all of us have had that experience of going into a meeting of some kind where we've just really not felt up to it. But, you know, if you were having that most mornings, what did you have to do? Fake it till you make it, I suppose, Andrew?
Look, you'd be surprised, I think, how many thousands of people out there are acting. People who have a condition which may operate most of the day, if not all day. I don't know how they do it, really, but they do. I mean, at least mine, I got relief from it. And the reason I confronted it in many ways is because it was starting to go later and later and later, you know, even up to midday or beyond, and some anxiety even persisted through the whole day. But for most of my working life, it was a problem till 9 o'clock, you know, and I'd have strategies to deal with that and try and get endorphins into my system to try and change my mood. I'd avoid breakfast, business breakfast, as best I could. I'd avoid anything before 8:30 if I could, and just be by myself. But I did have often conference calls at 8 o'clock when I was running the party, often acrimonious calls with the leader and others complaining about the headlines or whatever. And by the end of that, I was usually, you know, coming out of it because the adrenaline would be pumping because I'm engaged in that conversation. But often I'd really try and get myself in a good shape before that if I could.
It obviously affected your mood. Did it affect your self-confidence too?
Well, again, in the mornings, I'd have no confidence. I would not want to talk to people. I didn't want to take decisions. Often things I'd done the night before, of speeches I might have written that I was very pleased about and went to sleep very pleased, you know, that there were some points I wanted to make and I thought I'd made. I'd wake up in the morning and think, that's rubbish. You know, I should go and revisit all that because it's no good. But then by 9:30, you know, all that had changed. But so my mood was, everything about it was defensive, isolationist, you know, uncertain, lacking in confidence.
Did you have a sense when you were down that the world's just no good? More than you, it was the world at large, this is just a vale of tears. Did you have that sense as well?
Well, no, because I knew I'd pop out of it. You know, I'd be waiting some days for this cloud to lift. As I say, those people, and there are many of them, who have to deal with this 24/7, and in many cases, not tell anybody. In other words, you know, they put the fake smile on, which you do. You become very practiced. But I found when it got later and later, and I was chairing or participating in important meetings and whatever, to have to act for 4 hours in a number of high-level meetings and situations would really take it out of you. So I think a lot of people who've got, you know, some wonderful talents are often putting themselves or ending up in occupations where they can get by and they can act and they can, you know, they can rub through without people knowing, when if they confronted the condition and they found an answer to it, a whole new world would open up to them.
Once it had lifted at some point in the morning, what was that like? Was there a moment when you could just go, at last I can get my day started?
many moments like that. The one that that really got me to deal with it.
Here we go.
Telephone.
Tony Abbott complaining.
Actually, it was Tony Abbott. Can you believe that? I normally say that every time that's happened to me when I'm standing up making a speech. I say, "Oh, it's Tony Abbott. He can wait." That literally.
He's trying to tell you you're on the radio.
That literally was him. Anyway, that's the way it goes. It's a first. So where were we?
I was just asking you about that moment when you felt like you could get the day started at last.
Right. Yeah. Well, the clearest sort of example of that for me was when I was coming to the point of whether I would go public and really confront this thing. I was in a shadow cabinet meeting, and as you said at the outset, Malcolm had a problem with Godwin Gretsch. He'd had his Godwin Gretsch moment, if you remember, with the email. And after that, a lot of people were sort of doubting whether he would lead us to victory. And colleagues were asking me to consider whether I might challenge at some stage. And I'd say, I'm very interested, but I'll think about it. And the thing I was thinking about was whether it was compatible in the mornings with leadership, and clearly it wasn't. But
did any of your colleagues know you were going through this?
Well, in that later stage, when I went to see a psychiatrist and finally confronted it, I did speak to Tony Smith, who's someone I'd known for 20 years and had a close relationship with. But then I spoke to Peter Costello, who'd been also urging me to consider what I might do. But really, I think that was about it amongst the colleagues. But I was in this shadow cabinet meeting, and it was about 9 o'clock, and I was feeling terrible and defensive. And I'm sitting back from the table, and there was something going on. I was a bit acrimonious, and I'm sitting there thinking, there's absolutely no way I could be chairing this meeting. You know, wake up to yourself. Just put all those thoughts out of your mind. And then literally half an hour later, I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, God, I wish I was chairing this meeting, you know. And in the meantime, in half an hour, the cloud had lifted and I'm into it, you know, and I'm debating along with all the rest. So I came out of that meeting. That's the day, really, when I came out of that meeting. I rang my wife and said, I really have, this is not normal. I've got a problem. You know?
The fact that you were there was the situation that the Liberals at that stage were looking like in real trouble for the forthcoming election. It was the end of Malcolm Turnbull's leadership. You write in your book, Peter Costello was ringing you regularly, urging you to run against Malcolm Turnbull. Do you think that might have exacerbated the problem in some way? Piling pressure on might have actually made it even worse.
It might have, but I didn't.
I'm not trying to get Peter Costello for your problem.
No. The pressure wasn't the pressure. I suppose it was the opportunity. you have ambitions and you don't know whether, you know, how far you can go and all the rest of it. And I still didn't. But I was alert enough to know that because I'd been federal director and I'd been chief of staff to Andrew Peacock years ago when he was leader and ran a campaign. So I knew what was involved. You know, it's an enormously onerous position, that job, and it's really from 5:30 until 11 at night. You know, and you've got to be, you know, on the ball, initiating things, taking, you know, on the front foot with your colleagues and everybody else. And so I knew what was involved, and I kept thinking, I'll let everyone down. But I didn't like to rule it out at that stage because I thought if I rule this out or go and get treatment and everyone knows about it, that stigma that's been around for what had been around for so long, that anyone with depression has got a character weakness, that's how I had felt for 40 years. I think it's why I had not confronted or even admitted to myself that I had that I had depression.
Andrew Robb is my guest today in conversation, federal Liberal frontbencher. He's written a book called Black Dog Days, Public Life, Private Demons. So you went to the patron saint of politicians with depression, Jeff Kennett.
I did. Yeah.
What did Jeff Kennett say?
He was great. I rang him one Saturday morning and he was coming down out of the mountains in Tasmania for his Hawthorne plays occasionally in Launceston. And he and his wife, Felicity, were coming down, and he said, bad line here, Andrew, I'll ring you back at 1:30 when I've got to the match. Sure enough, on the dot. So I quickly explained both the condition that I'd had for a long time and some of the politics. And he said, oh, Andrew, look, I'm no expert, but he said, I'll see what I can do to find someone who knows what he's talking about to give you a diagnosis. And he said, oh, by the way, he said, congratulations. He said, 90% of this is confronting it. And so he then on the Monday morning, 8 o'clock, he rang through to say, I've got someone, you're meeting him at 8 o'clock on Wednesday morning, and good luck. It was a typical Jeff.
So you went to see this doctor, Professor Tiller, and what did he tell you after you described your symptoms to him?
Well, I'd had a previous experience 6 months before, so even before the leadership issue, I had sort of decided in my own mind that, this was getting difficult and getting worse. And I went along to my own doctor and my GP, and I told him about it, and I said, you haven't got a pill, have you, to make me feel a bit better? And he said, oh, Andrew, this medication, it's nonsense. It's all in the head, he said. It's psychological, all these things. And he gave me a card of some lovely old dear around nearby to go and see and have a chat to. So 2 weeks later, I fronted, sitting up in the parlour, and she's got the paper out, and she asked me to tell her what had happened. So I'd only spent 10 minutes, giving some detail of the condition, and she said, could I stop you for a second? And she said, Andrew, were you loved by your parents when you were a child? Well, honestly, I sat there and thought, I've got to get out of here. This is not for me, And I paid her a cheque and wished her a good day. And I went home and, again, did what I had done for decades, saying to myself, don't be so weak, snap yourself out of it, tackle things, get into it, throw yourself in. And I really made a serious effort for 5 months to take things on and, get up in the morning and try and talk to people and all those sort of things.
So we don't say that to people with cancer, do we? I mean,
you don't
say, oh, just, snap out of it.
Well, it's
not really, a perfect analogy, but nonetheless, you're telling yourself that you need to snap out of it, son, manage it better. And all that.
I just, it's part of not wanting to admit that you've got a problem, because I thought a lot of the things that I aspired to, I have a lot of self-belief, but hopefully I know my limitations and what I'm good at. I'm a great believer in people identifying what your strengths and weaknesses are and then focusing on those strengths, right? A lot of people spend a lot of their life, I think, trying to demonstrate to others that weaknesses they've got and have been criticised about are not really weaknesses. If they spent half the time focusing on what the God-given talents have been given, they'd be much happier and everyone around them would be much happier. So, I'm a decision maker and I love responsibility, and it's turned out I love public life and the things you can do. So
it's funny you should say that, though, because I was reading an article recently. I'm not a doctor. I'm not an expert at these things, but talking about politicians who had depression, and they've looked at people like, famously, of course, Winston Churchill, who coined the phrase black dog, and Abraham Lincoln, who many people feel quite certain suffered a certain kind of depression, probably very different in nature to yours. Nonetheless, there's a theory that says, that people with depression lack the reality distortion field that optimists have, and so they're more capable of seeing the world realistically in a funny sort of way, without the kind of expectation that everything's going to work out fine in the end. It seems to dovetail what you were just saying.
Well, if that's the case, I've had the benefit of both sides of that coin, because for much of the day, through most of my life, people would see me as an optimist. I look for opportunities, and even when things are going badly, I'll look to see what the opportunity might be if we fix it. But in the mornings, forget it. I mean, I'm the opposite. So
now, I'd asked you before about you went to see this first site doctor who said wanted to know about where you loved as a child.
Oh yes, Tiller. What did
and then you went to this a more senior doctor, should I put it that way, Professor Tiller. He's
a senior psychiatrist. He's well renowned, actually. He's a lovely man. Again, he said, sit down. I wasn't on a couch this time, so I felt even better in that way. But I started to tell him, and he's taking notes. And then after about 10 minutes, he said, could I stop you, Andrew? And my heart sank.
Here we go.
I thought, here we go, you know, were you loved by your mother and father? And he said, Andrew, from what you've said already, he said, you've got a chemical problem. It's fixable. Now go on. Well, you know, I could have been dancing on the chair. It was just such a relief to realise someone thought I did have a problem that was identifiable, which he even gave a name to later on, diurnal variation, but also that that there was a prospect of fixing it.
So the diagnosis is one thing that lifted you up. The second thing is the prognosis that it was fixable.
Fixable.
What is diurnal variation?
It just means daily variation in mood. So, you know, I've got a colleague who's got something very similar in South Australia, but she doesn't come out of it until about 3 o'clock.
Oh.
Right. So it's really taxing, and she's still tackling different medications, and she's still in that process. But so it can take all sorts of forms. But it's just one form of depression. There are many forms of depression and mental health. This is just my story and my version of what I had. But it involves each day a variation in your mood caused by chemicals. I release serotonin or produce serotonin, which fires you up for the day, several hours later than most other people. Usually they start to produce it at 6 o'clock, at 2 o'clock, sorry, in the morning. Most people, I start to produce at around 6 or 7, or I did. I've now been in great shape for 18 months. So, but it's interesting the way in which they determine that. My psychiatrist said, you've got a chemical problem and we've got to find something to deal with the depression. But he said, there's a lot of things that are not known, and we're now starting to see other causes. And he said the body cycles are very important. He said, go and see this so-called sleep doctor. I didn't have a problem, never had a problem sleeping, but it was still a specialist on the body cycles. And I went to see this chap, and he gave me an electronic pill, which I swallowed. It took 2 days to go through me, and he strapped a receiver on my chest. And each 10 seconds, the pill transmitted my core body temperature. And at the end of the 2 days, he took all that data and put it and graphed it. And he said, there's your problem.
What was your problem?
My problem, he said, was my core body temperature hit a minimum between 6 and 7 a.m. both mornings. And he said, when your core body temperature hits a minimum and starts to go up again, it sends a signal to the brain to stop producing melatonin, which your body's full of overnight, and start producing serotonin, which is appropriate to fire you up for the day. Well, I wouldn't start that process until 6 or 7. I'm already wandering around, right? Whereas most people would start that between 2 and 3. By the time they get up, their body's got a significant level of serotonin, much less melatonin, and, you know, they have a normal morning. But so I would, until my body filled up with serotonin, that period, as it turned out, not everyone's the same, but for me and many others, it's associated with a depressive condition.
So at this stage, it's really only you and perhaps your wife and your doctor who know about this. And
pretty much,
Peter Costello was still ringing you, urging you to challenge Malcolm Turnbull for the leadership at this point. Were you able to tell him then once this was...
Well, actually, what happened, I went to the psychiatrist and I was going... It was Parliament was sitting, so I'd made some excuse to get home for that morning, and I was out at the airport about 10:30 going back, and the phone rang. And it was Peter Costello in Parliament House, assuming I was just in my office or whatever, in Parliament House. And I said, I'm at Melbourne Airport. And then I'm thinking while I'm talking to him, you know, I better tell him. He's a senior colleague, he's a long-term friend. we'd been associated before either of us got involved in politics. And so I told him I could trust him. And so I told him what had happened, what had just, the interview I'd just had with the psychiatrist. And I was so pumped because I thought, I can deal with this in 4 weeks, because he'd put me straight onto a medication. And he said there'll be some side effects. Your body will get used to the side effects, and then you'll find out if it works. I assume 5 weeks' time, it's all fixed.
Be good.
All
Tickety
fixed,
boo.
And yeah. Then I can make decisions, right? So, and I think I was so upbeat that he sort of went along with it. And but of course it didn't. I mean, when the psychiatrist said to me, "It is fixable," but he said, "We've got to experiment." He said, "Because it's not an exact science." And he said there'll be side effects. And it might take a while. I didn't hear those qualifications.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
Today my guest is Federal Liberal frontbencher Andrew Robb. Andrew's book is called Black Dog Days, Public Life, Private Demons. And we've been speaking about the time when he stood down from the Liberal front bench in order to be treated for his ongoing case of depression, which was sort of creeping up on him and getting a little bit worse and a little bit worse year after year. So there you are, you're confident. This is 2009, I think, Andrew, wasn't it?
And yes.
You're pretty confident that, oh, great, the doctors picked it. Yes, this makes sense to me. I have diurnal variation. This is all treatable. It's just chemicals. I can get this sorted. You put on medication, but he has said there'll be side effects. How was your first 2 weeks on this first medication you took, Andrew?
Well, the first 4 weeks until my body adjusted were the worst 4 weeks of my life, without qualification. I'd read the possible side effects in the documentation. I think they had about 24, every conceivable ailment you could develop, and I thought, oh, they're just covering themselves, you know, which fair enough. But right in the middle, you know, number 13 was severe depression. In other words, you could end up with a lot worse condition for a while taking this pill. And in fact,
that was you.
That was me. And in fact, a week later, the psychiatrist got my wife to come in to warn her about this and to say, you know, we always warn people close to the client. Or patient, to watch out for suicide. That's the effect the pill can have on some people. But it gave me depression, not just for the first 3 or 4 or 5 hours, but 24/7 deep depression. The only time I was in any sort of shape was when I was speaking. Like I had the responsibility for climate change, and it was all coming to a head back in 2009, and I was doing press conferences and. Most days I'd be addressing, you know, a room full of CEOs, or and I'd have meetings at night with 100 people, and you know what it's like. There's a big issue happening, and when I was on my feet, the adrenaline would pump. I knew my subject, so no one could pick. There was a problem, but as soon as I sat down or going to meetings, I'd be sitting out in the sun trying to get something that would sort of give me a lift. And but in between all of these public commitments, whether it was in the parliament or outside, I'd sit in my office and all I could do was look at the wall. I didn't want to make phone calls, do emails, anything. I'd just sit there, look at the wall for 2 hours at a time.
Your wife tried to sort of improve your mood by going off on a kind of coastal sort of holiday house for a bit, and that didn't
We work. Had in the middle of it, we had a disastrous weekend. One of my sisters, Janet, has got a place down on the coast in Victoria, and it's a lovely little place with nice views. And so we went down for the weekend, just the two of us, my wife Maureen and I. And there's an account in the book of that weekend by her, because I mean, I can remember it, but I sat on the couch. I didn't want to watch the football, I didn't want to listen to the radio, I love music, all sorts, and I didn't want that on. I sat there with a rug over me in front of the fire. And I was just in a total funk. I mean, I just didn't want to do anything, say anything. And she tried
like
to get...
Yeah, what was it like for you to read your wife's account of that and see how deeply worried she was about
it? Well, it really did give me a jolt, because I just asked her, could she write down some recollections to help me, you know, write the book? And then when she'd finished that, I thought, this has got to go in the book, because it was an interesting observation from someone close to me who had to deal with it. And she was on watch all weekend. I mean, we love looking at real estate and things like that. And she, Saturday afternoon, she said, you know, let's get in the car and go and have a round, look at some of the places that have been built around here, which normally I would jump at, you know. And she said, I look like thunder, as though, you know, you want me to do what? But anyway, I went. I sat curled up in the corner of the front seat, in the passenger seat, uninterested in all of it. That was, the whole weekend was like that. And she said it's the worst weekend she's ever had. But it really was a shock. And she made sure that I reported all this back to the psychiatrist. But I did, my body did adjust after 4 weeks, but I didn't see any improvement. And that's when it got ugly.
That's when it got ugly, yeah. There's a kind of terrifying account there where you were, it was, things were coming to a crunch on climate change. Malcolm Turnbull was having a shadow parliamentary meeting and he called you in after you sort of retreated, I think, I don't know, was it a courtyard where you were there?
Yeah,
yes,
yeah, so it was.
And
yeah, it was exactly a few days later after that, like, okay, my body adjusted for 4 weeks, after 4 weeks to the that pill and the depression. No change to the underlying condition. I go to the psychiatrist and he says, I said, what do we do now? And he said, oh, I think we'll double the dose. Same medication. And I said, will I have the same side effects? He said, possibly. Well, of course. The next week I'm in Canberra. We were sitting and he was right. I was even worse, I think. And I went in the party room meeting on the Tuesday morning. I went into the party room. And the leaders usually say a few things to start with. And I was feeling so down and just, I didn't want to know anybody or the world. And I looked outside, the sun was shining. So I just eased my way out the back and went down, out of the parliament, down over the road that goes around the main building. There's all sorts of these little gardens and wisteria, and it's a lovely little spot. The sun was shining through. And I sat on a bench there for 50 minutes. And just letting the sun beat on my shoulders and get some relief. And I didn't want to do anything, and then the phone rang. And it was my staffer saying Malcolm Turnbull wanted me back in the party room. Well, it only meant one thing, and that was some issue had come up in my area. And of course it had. They were all going for Malcolm over climate change. And honestly, I got back in, and he said, oh, Andrew's back. There's five more speakers. He will sum up. And I sat there through the five speakers trying to make a note what I would say. If the floor had opened up, I would have gladly disappeared. And I felt just shocking. And then, but as I got up to speak, the adrenaline pumped. I got up and I dealt with the situation effectively. It had been very ugly. And without putting him down, but I'd given everyone an assurance that there was a process and they would have a part of it. Malcolm wouldn't make the decision. And anyway, whatever I said, I can't remember. But
so the adrenaline kicked in it.
And when I got
just that much, as you were getting to your feet.
As like every time I was speaking or on the spot, the adrenaline would pump and I'd be okay. So, of course, Peter Costello and others who'd been on my back to make a decision, and especially Peter, who knew that I'd been, thought, Robbie's back. You know, he's nailed it. Well, he rang me half an hour. I went straight back out. After I'd spoken, I was in the same frame of mind. I was sitting in the office with the door shut, and he rang. And he said, you know, he's got this big booming voice. Ah, oh, Robbie, he says, how's things? And I said, I've never been so bad in all my life. And I've never been so bad in all my life. He said, oh, right. He said, well, get well. And he was really taken aback. He didn't know what to say. And
so you rang Malcolm Turnbull, said you'd be stepping down for a bit.
So I thought, well, I spent a few hours then thinking, this is crunch time. There's people still wanting to know what I'm going to do. And I'm not making decisions. I'm starting to look a goose, really. You know, how long does it take? So But anyway, I thought all afternoon I spent, what's the consequence of going public? I thought I can't take Get Some Space and go without explaining to people what it is. I didn't want to make up some other reason. And after a while I thought, I don't care. If I can fix this, that's the most important thing. I'm on a pathway here and I'm not going to stop. And if it finishes my political career, well, so be it.
So you rang Malcolm Turnbull?
Then I went and saw Malcolm that night.
And how was he with your...
He was very good. I've known him a long time. I mean, we've had an issue or two that we had a difference with over climate change.
Yeah, I reckon.
Yes. but he's a decent fellow. And he was most concerned and happy to do whatever it took to help me and facilitated that. We worked out a game plan very quickly.
So you spoke to Laurie Oakes. That was the way you were going to let the whole... Well, Australia know about
yes.
why you were doing what you were doing.
Oh, yes.
He wrote quite a straightforward article, actually, wasn't it? I read the text of that. It was very straightforward, explained what you've been experiencing and why. And quite frankly, the response to it all was pretty grown up, wasn't it, Andrew?
It was fantastic. In fact, I didn't know what the reaction... Well, I'd spent 40 years thinking the reaction would be, well, poor old Andrew. You know, and
he's mad.
He's mad. Yes. Yeah, he's a loony. You know, he's you know what it was like back then, and it's still for someone of my generation, it hangs over, and it had stood in the way for so long, and I didn't know what the reaction would be, but I literally got hundreds of emails from people I've never heard of, and who were either thanking me or identifying with it or asking me questions. It's really why, in the end, I've written the book, because it's 2 years since I went public. It wasn't a front page story. I mean, it got some publicity, but it wasn't you know, what you'd call a huge news story. But yet, I can't go anywhere where people come up to me and either ask for advice or thank me or want to talk about it. You know, I've had depression, or I've got depression, kindred spirit, all this sort of thing, or got family members.
Is that hard? Because a lot of those conversations are going to be really quite emotional, and they're going to take a lot of time. And
I figure, look, I suppose the thing is, I was in a privileged position. I mean, I'd got a knockback from my local doctor. Now, I bet that a lot of people out there, a lot of doctors do a great job with this, others, you know, not up to speed on still. I bet a lot of people have not found a way to deal with it, even if they've gone to their doctor. Yet I was in the position where, second time round, I've decided I've got to do something. I could pick up the phone to the person who runs Beyond Blue, and who's someone who has got strong connections. I can end up with one of the best fellows in Australia. Now, I thought that puts some responsibility on me to do what I can to give people the opportunity or the realisation that they can confront it, they can actually come out the other end, even in the same job, or go to higher responsibilities. That not everyone will, but a lot of them can. And you just have to decide, first and foremost, confront this thing.
So you changed your medication, and it was brought up to a point where it made a difference. Tell me about that difference, when that kicked in, when your medication changed, and the dosage was brought to a point where it actually started to seriously work for you.
Yes. Well, it was about 6 months later. It took a long time, and different medications, and then different levels of medication. The one I finally ended up on, which is called Pristic, I tried it at 50 milligrams, 100 milligrams, 150 milligrams, 200 milligrams, rang the psychiatrist and said, I've gone through the cycle again, no change. It made me very tired, that pill, but my body would get used to it, and I'd come out of that. But then he said, well, Andrew, go to 250 or 300. I'll leave it up to you. And I thought, right, 300. And I took that, and the next day I felt a lot better. And then for the next 2 days, it went back a bit. And about the fourth day, I was in the bathroom at 5:45. I go for a swim every morning, and I'm usually dragging myself. I got in the bathroom, and I thought, I can't believe I got this clear head. And really clear head. It's like I'd have it, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I had no apprehension, or if the phone rang with an interview, you know, from some, you know, well-meaning journalist, bring it on, you know. Honestly, Richard, I have not had a morning since then which has not come up to that standard. It's been unbelievable.
So you're as close to giddy as you've ever been in your life.
Well, it was just, I was almost sort of dancing on the spot and pinching myself, you know, and I thought, I kept thinking, oh, you know, this will only last a day or two, but I didn't tell anyone really except my wife. I said, I think things are... I was like that for 5 days before I said anything to anybody because I was just hoping it wasn't going to collapse on me.
I'm sure if your doctor was here, your doctor would probably say that the specific drug you took has worked for you, but it won't necessarily work for other people. But it's, yes, in your case, it's worked for you. But you also got a little blue light that you take with you. Tell me about
this. Well, as I say, he said to me, look, there's lots of other treatments, acupuncture and all sorts of things, which 20 years ago was seen as witchcraft in Australia. But he said they've all got some basis to them, and there's, well, many of them have. And anyway, for me, I got to this sleep doctor who talked about the cycles, and he said you can move, you know, the 6 o'clock release of serotonin back, but it's complicated. You take the melatonin tablet early the night before, so your body fills up with melatonin, and then this blue light. You've got some cells in your eyes which are not there for seeing. They're there to record the different light changes. And when morning comes, the blue part of the light spectrum hits these cells in your eyes, which also says to your brain it's time to produce serious amounts of serotonin, right? So, and even if you've got your eyes closed, you know, the light still goes through. So each morning for 12 months, really, I would get up at 6. Or before 6, I'd have half an hour, read the papers, have this light shine across my eyes, take the melatonin tablet and the medication, and, you know, who knows what's working? They don't know. I mean, there's still so much they don't know about the brain, but I was very happy to try all these combinations because clinically it had been seen to work.
I should say at the beginning, I've got Andrew Robb here, who's a federal Liberal frontbencher, and he's written a book called Black Dog Days, Private Life, Public Life, Private Demons, which is largely about his life, but also his long struggle with depression, which you've now pretty well treated successfully. Once you were starting to feel better, you were looking to become involved in politics again, and then we come to that crucial moment in 2009, the end of 2009, when the climate change issue was coming to a head, and you spoke up in the party room. You went back on the front bench at that stage.
I hadn't even nailed it then. Was that about the 3 month mark, I think? I'd got over the one that made me depressed, but we'd stopped with that one. We'd decided that wasn't going to work. And I was onto this one that I've ultimately finished up with, but I was still at low level. So I was still really with my original condition because it hadn't beaten it. And plus I was tired, the side effect of that pill. So, but no one really, I wasn't telling people a sort of week by week account of how I was going. So they just assumed Andrew's, I'm in the party room, I'm still doing my electorate work, but I wasn't doing anything public. So they didn't even know whether I would speak in the party room or whatever. But I had spent a year, I probably knew more about it than any of my colleagues, and I felt very strongly about it. And
it was the catalyst that undid Malcolm Turnbull's leadership, was your speech to that party room, wasn't it?
I think so, yes. So I could. The debate went for 7.5 hours, and I was desperate to get up early so that I could get some information on the table that I thought most of my colleagues didn't have, another perspective on the negotiations that had taken place. And it was presented, I thought, in a really Pollyanna sort of view, as though we'd won 80% of what we wanted, and what was very bad legislation, very interventionist, high taxing, all the rest, all the sort of stuff you're hearing now. I thought it was being presented as though much of that had been addressed, when I thought it was a 10% result. And anyway, I got up and early after about an hour, and there's some issues around that too, but as to how I did that. But I got up and I got two extensions of 5 minutes, so I ended up with 15 minutes, and it had a big impact. I mean, Malcolm took it very... very hard, because I didn't tell him beforehand, but I've seen Malcolm in business I mean, he's a driven fellow, and once he's made up his mind, he was bulldozing this thing through, in my view, in the most. And I thought it was perhaps the biggest structural change that we will confront, many of my colleagues would ever confront in their parliamentary career, and that it needed to be dealt with in a highly considered and informed manner. And yet they got all the detail that morning and then had to vote that afternoon. So I thought my intervention was critical, but I knew that if I went early and told him what was happening, I felt that I'd end up as the last speaker or something else, you know.
So we know that Malcolm Turnbull and his closest colleagues felt blindsided by your intervention, and that you'd intervened without letting them know. And they accused you of great betrayal.
They accused me of treason, or treachery, sorry, not treason, treachery. But I felt that, I've got to say, that presenting the results of very complicated and major negotiations on what it was already a very complex issue that most people didn't know much about, presenting that to them and then asking them to vote immediately afterwards, have a debate and vote, I thought that was treachery in a way. And at the end it was much bigger than Malcolm or me or any of the other colleagues. The thing is, it will so fundamentally impact that we've got to make considered decisions on this, not political decisions, not decisions that we think are going to help us politically.
But they are by nature political decisions.
Well, they are, but that shouldn't be the overwhelming motivation for taking a position. I mean, that's on the policy. That's why I feel so strongly about the carbon tax. I mean, it is because Bob Brown said that's a condition of us supporting the government. And I think if they took an economic decision and look what the rest of the world is not doing, they would be far more considered about how they go about this major policy issue.
Many economists disagree with you on that. And I think Tony Abbott's even said, well, what do we need to listen to economists for?
I got first-class honours in economics. I worked as an economist for years. I did modelling. I did a lot more modelling than a lot of the economists who are so-called quoted. And I've lived this issue and the science of it, and I've got a science qualification as well. So, and I've lived it for many years, and it's not a market mechanism to bring in $11 billion worth of taxes, of which only $1.8 billion of it is actually the cost of abatement, and the rest is pure tax. There's a lot of misnomers around this issue, and as I say, I could name you a lot of economists. I could identify around the world many, many economists who hold my view.
After you'd made that speech, Malcolm Turnbull's a rather forthright human being. Did he give you a phone call to explain your shortcomings to you, Andrew?
Well, the debate went for 7 hours and it went through over lunch. We stopped for lunch and I was back in my office and I got a phone call from Malcolm. So there's still 4 hours to go of the debate, but I got perhaps the by far the strongest character assessment that I've ever had. And the thing about Malcolm, he's got this huge brain box and he can marshal invective and you know, other things very quickly and very effectively. And so I got all barrels for about probably nearly a minute, I think. But
how close was the phone to your ear? Was it?
I didn't have to. You know, he wasn't yelling so much. It was, he had a raised voice, but look, I didn't care. I mean, I'd thought all that through long before, and it's water off a duck's back to me. The issue was much more important, as I said, than either of us, and I knew he'd be uptight. He'd staked, a lot on getting it through, and he'd be disappointed. He would have felt having been his shadow minister. But in some ways, I had felt that he'd chosen me because he thought I'd be a bridge to the right, but that I'd ultimately do his bidding. Well, I'm nobody's man.
How are you managing now?
I've never been better. I've got not only finance responsibility, but also responsibility for coordinating all of our policy development. So it's fascinating, stimulating, and I do feel if we get the privilege of governing, we need to arrive with a very solid agenda. So
I'm talking about you, me, emotionally, of course.
Well, emotionally, yeah.
and mood-wise, I suppose, rather than
emotionally? I'm now, like all day, like I was for a lot of the day before I had this dealt with the issue, I'm in a great frame of mind. I wake up ready to take on the world, and it doesn't seem to stop all day. So it's been by far, in a mood sense, I haven't been like this since I was a kid.
Does it get you thinking about what it is to be happy?
Well, I mean, I can't say. I mean, I've had a great life, so, because I would pop out of it. So, you know, I've had many...
That's what I mean. It's given you an interesting perspective, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, I had both sides of the coin, as I said, all my life, most of my life. So, but it is... it's sort of frustrating in a way that I feel if I'd confronted it earlier, there's quite a few hours when you add them up over 40 years, 43 years, where I was in this funk and I could have been different. But anyway, you can't think backwards.
You wouldn't be the same person though, would you?
No, I suspect in lots of ways dealing with it has probably meant that some of the resilience I might have, it must have affected me in... I think I've gained lots of things from it, and it's helped me really establish my sense of, you know, what is the, you know, we're always thinking from time to time, what's the meaning of life? And I really think, and politics helps you with this, you identify lots of people who are in lot worse situations than I've ever been in, who you can see still realise that there are expectations of them, no matter what their environment is. And that's where you get satisfaction and happiness, by making the most of this talent you've got, no matter what your circumstance and what situation you're in.
Andrew Roberts, fascinating speaking to you today, and thank you so much for your insights into your life and career today. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, Richard. Thanks.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.